All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. Yes, I am Jay Taylor, talking to you from New York City, the borough of Queens, to be exact. It is the 29th day of September, 2020. And I do always like to thank you for listening to this show and making it one of the more popular shows in the business on the business channel, the Voice America Business Channel. Always encourage you to send along your questions to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com, questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. Any comments you might have, good, bad, or indifferent, we like to hear from you. We do always want to thank our sponsors, the mining companies that make this show economically viable, Benchmark Metals, NV Gold, Hannon Metals, Irving Resources, Novo Resources, Sitka Gold Corp., and Lion One Metals are this week's sponsors. Before I begin talking about today's show, I want to suggest that this pullback in the price of gold and silver is an opportunity for investors who were not listening to this show back in 2016 when Michael Oliver's proprietary momentum and structural analysis work had his subscribers buying gold in the low 1100s. And then a little later, 2018, Michael suggested that people should ante up some more, buy some more gold at $1,200. So looking back, you might have said woulda, shoulda, coulda, but this current based, I think the current basing area that we have seen now, I don't know, somewhere around $1,850 to $2,000, that, I think in the future this may be seen as another great buying opportunity. We'll hear what Michael has to say about that in a few minutes, but of course, most people only think in terms of the price of gold as denominated in their currencies, in dollars, in the case of myself. Most people don't understand that gold isn't gaining in value, but rather that the currencies against which they measure the price of gold and silver and other commodities is a self-destructing unit of measure. Hence, the need to protect your wealth by swapping your paper money, your fiat money, the money that you are forced to use by law, swap that into gold or silver, which, unlike fiat money, has tangible value that lasts as long as the good Lord allows this earth to exist. It has lasted for centuries, actually. So even though my personal portfolio is down a bit as a result of this pullback, I look at this basing period for gold and silver as a blessing for investors who recognize now, who recognize the need to own gold and silver, may not have gotten in back at those lower levels, but I think there's an opportunity now. Some of those people that are really starting to believe that they need to own some gold and silver, that's why I designed my course, Investing 101 Gold, Silver, and the Miners. And that course will be launched on Thursday, October 1, first day of October. And you can go to course.miningstocks.com to sign up for it, the course on October 1st. Even if you have some gold and silver, and I hope you do, that you have some in your possession, and maybe you haven't invested in the mining shares, so if that's the case, this course may be of value to you in that regard as well. I'd be using the experience that I've gathered over the last three or four decades in studying, analyzing, writing, investing about mining shares to pass that along in the course. And more importantly, Dr. Quentin Henning, who is probably the most sought-after exploration geologist in the world, at least certainly one of them, he is also providing some some information about what he looks for before he invests his time, his good name, and his money in various mining projects. So the show, so again, that is course.miningstocks.com, course.miningstocks.com to sign up for my newsletter, for my course. It starts on October 1st. All right, with regard to today's show, I've titled it Rose-Colored Glasses or Reality. Lynn Alden, Michael Oliver, and Peter Ball return as guests. Legendary stock guru Richard Russell used to say that stockbrokers became wealthy because they didn't buy their own BS. Well, Washington and Wall Street are known for spinning tall tales of nirvana. They tell you how wonderful shares of stock are that they really can't wait to sell you. Wall Street's friends in Washington, I would suggest, are much of the same mindset. They also have a kind of snake oil that they can't wait to sell you. So not surprisingly, the Congressional Budget Office proclaims that there will be a V-shaped recovery with minimal future stimulus, and that federal debt as a percentage of GDP will quickly level off and remain level throughout the 2020s. Well, that really sounds like a rosy scenario to me. I do hope the CBO is right. Who in their right mind would not wish that to be true? But something is telling me that neither Michael Oliver or Lynn Alden, neither of whom are known to don rose-colored glasses, will see such a quick turn, a V-shaped recovery, if you will, back to normalcy. I hope that that happens, but I personally have my reservations, and we'll hear what Lynn has to say in the second half of today's show. We'll see what her prognosis is for the economy. And as I mentioned in the second segment, Peter Ball will be with me. He heads up NV Gold Corporation. NV Gold has three very exciting gold projects, two in Nevada and one in British Columbia. All three of them will be seeing some drilling done before the end of this year. So I think this is a story, a very low-cap company that I'm really excited about, and I'm eager to hear what Peter has to tell us in the second segment right after our first commercial break. But getting back to the question of whether or not we can look forward to a V-shaped recovery, I am happy to tell you that Michael Oliver is with me now to share his thoughts and on that topic and more. Thanks for joining me, Michael.
Hi, Jake. Good to be back.
It's always good to have you back every other week. We can't get you every week. You're too much in demand, but we're glad at least we can get you every other week. So we've had this correction. Is it a correction in gold? And, you know, what do you think we've bottomed yet, or what are your thoughts on gold right now from a longer-term perspective?
Good chance that was the low. This is sort of a lesser version of what happened in March, which was really, it was also very short-lived. The sell-off in silver and gold miners in particular, gold didn't have such a hit then, but the gold miners and the silver market back then had this V-shaped sell-off and recovery that you could measure literally in days. And so what they took away in days, they grabbed it all back and then two and three times as much in the next several weeks. And I think that I hardly even call it a correction, because most of our momentum metrics, call it short-term metrics, peaked in August, early August, with the price high, which was, you know, 2070 on spot gold. But then you had this very sharp sell-off into mid-August that lasted about 2 days. You got down into the, I think it was about 1870, 1860 on the nearby contract. And then you shot back up and spent the next month or two going sideways in between the high and the low. So you really weren't selling off anymore. But then as you crept along in time, and again, we measure things in time, not just momentum measurements, but how long is the momentum chart going down? In the case of a weekly oscillator, to be going down for 6, 7, 8 weeks, while price is mainly going sideways, is aging the process, meaning the corrective process is accumulating age on the downside. And yet the bears couldn't make any ground on it until last Wednesday. They finally went down and punched out that August 11th, August 12th low by enough to take it out. So you could say, oh, I ran the stops. And no doubt they did. Silver did a comparable thing, only deeper. And so did the gold miners. They all went down and took out an obvious price chart low, and they're all back above it now. You know, it was like a quick sting, and then, boop, right back up into the prior range. Mm-hmm. So I tend to think that that might have been the low, and partly because of the age process. In other words, the sellers had been selling for like 2 months, and finally they made some money if they grabbed it. Right now, probably most of the sellers are about break even.
Right, so, right. And so, Michael, I mean, most people watch the charts, and I look at your work all the time, and most often, I mean, you're really basing your thinking on the momentum work, usually. So if your momentum is still looking strong, you're not worried. But other people are looking at the charts, and they're getting, you know, they're having nervy busts over the declines.
Well, yeah, the long-term momentum, which is what our primary thing we try to focus on. That's why we call the bottom at 1140 in February 2016, et cetera, et cetera. There's nothing in it, when you plot those charts, that is in danger of breaking. In other words, there's not even a trend structure, you know, where you could draw a line and say, okay, this is an uptrend or this is a floor, and there's not even one nearby. Therefore, usually the rule of thumb is this: if there's nothing to break, you're not going to change your trend. It has to be pretty obvious, like the bridge on the River Kwai. You can't blow it up and have it crash until they build it. And so there is no structure that's vulnerable on long-term gold charts. The only thing that looks vulnerable is the day-to-day action, which unfortunately too many investors are focused on. And I feel sorry for them, because if you jump every time they say boo, one time you're not going to get back in.
Well, more than one time.
You know,
And this is why you're so valuable to me as a longer-term investor in gold mining shares and other things as well. If you take a longer-term perspective, it's just very helpful to feel, you know, not to be able to sleep at night, not worrying about your position when you go to bed at night. So that's so helpful. What about the dollar, Michael? How's that looking to you these days?
The dollar's had a rally, basically. If you look at a dollar index daily chart, you'll see that it made a low about the same time gold made a high. And then the dollar had a bit of a rally, not much, insignificant, percent or so. And then it went sideways for about 7-8 weeks, just like gold did, off of its high, but went sideways. And then the dollar, 2 weeks ago, had a little surge finally. You know, where you could actually see it. And all the people talking about strong dollar came back on board again, a dollar strong. When you stand back and look at a dollar chart going back 40 years, it is an anemic-looking beast. It's in a major downtrend. You have rallies here and there, but basically it's in dire straits. And the recent rally is insignificant. I think it's about out of gas. I suspect the dollar is going to roll over within a week or two and head back down again. And it may be coincident with gold flipping back up again. Not that they have to be totally inverse, but it might just be the case. So I don't trust the dollar rally. I think it's got a lot further to go on the downside. And realize dollar's trading around 93, 94 right now, dollar index. The high in March was 103. And to be 10% off of a high in several months, that's a big move for the dollar.
Yeah, downside. Better believe it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Ray Dalio talks about how right now the dollar is in some trouble longer term, but there's no other major currency that you can go to, but people are going to stuff. They're buying commodities, they're buying gold, they're buying other tangibles. And I know that your position in commodities, your thoughts about commodities, you've been generally very bullish. What are your thoughts right now?
So, the Bloomberg Commodity Index, I would watch it, because this month's high on the Bloomberg Commodity Index was 73.9 something, just short of 74. If during the fourth quarter, which starts Thursday, we see the dollar index back up to 73.5, right now it's trading around 71. Because back to 73.5, which is does not even require taking out this past month's high, I'm going to engage quarterly momentum on the dollar index in a massive breakout. In which case, I think at that point, instead of the arm wrestling upside that the dollar, that Bloomberg has had over the last several months since March, it was down in the 50s, will become more explosive. And I think it'll become noticeable and become a headline in the financial press and be further wind at the back of gold.
So we're looking for a number of 0.735? Did I hear you correctly?
A couple points above where you are right now, 73.5 area. If you trade that number again, you just sort of return near this month's high during the fourth quarter, and I think it's for real. They're going to launch it. And my suspicion is, expectation is, the first leg up will take the Bloomberg Commodity Index up to around 110. Mm. Now, you go from 70 to 110 is a large
move. Wow, that's quite a move. That's quite a move.
Yeah.
Well, we know that the Chinese are supposedly buying lots of commodities, and including copper. So anyway, who knows what the – you're looking at the charts, and your work is just impeccable. It's just so valuable to me, Michael. And for all of you folks, you should be checking in with Michael and signing up for his service. It's olivermsa.com, olivermsa.com. Thanks so much for being with us again, Michael. And all the best to you, and all the best to you and your family out there in the Rocky Mountains now. So take care.
Thank you, Jay. Bye.
All right, folks. Well, we do have to go to break now, but Peter Ball will be with us. He's of NV Gold. That's NV, the initials NV, not NV like a socialist. NV Gold Corporation. Peter will be with me right after the break, so don't go away.
Novo Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm here with Peter Ball, the president and CEO of NV Gold Corporation. Peter brings with him over 30 years of experience as a mining professional at various levels, and what really impresses me is the wide range of experiences that he's had in the mining sector. He has been in senior management roles with various major companies in the past, but in areas of finance, securities trading, mine engineering, business development, corporate communications, public relations, and marketing functions. And all those things are part of what small junior mining companies need, those skill sets. And so Peter has the science engineering background as well as a commercial background. And I think it makes him very well suited to head up this company, which is quickly becoming one of my favorites. NV Gold Corporation trades in Toronto. Its symbol is NVX. You can buy it down here in the States, as I have, under the symbol NVGLF. 64.8 million shares I saw earlier this morning, selling at only 28 cents in Canadian money, giving it a market cap of a mere 18.2 million or thereabouts in Canadian money. So, well, thanks for joining me again, Peter.
Afternoon, Jay. Always a pleasure to join your program.
Yeah, it's good to have you. And, you know, it's good to have you because you got a lot of exciting things going on. And you have some 16 active projects, but you're focused on three, I guess, that you think are probably the ones that offer the most upside, the greatest promise. You did introduce those three projects when you were last on the show on July 28th, but I know that you've been doing some work on all of them since then, so I'd like you to bring us up to date. You've got the Sandy project and the Slumber projects in Nevada. Those are two that you're focusing on. And then one that you explained last time, Exodus Gold Project, which sort of by happenstance or by a miracle, you picked up that project, which you're very excited about. But could you perhaps update us first on the two Nevada projects and what you've done since we last spoke to you?
Yeah, absolutely, Jay. Let's start down in Nevada. It's kind of an excellent day to have another conversation and bring your listeners up to speed of what NV Gold's been doing the last couple of months. This morning,
We'll start off with Sandy. This morning we announced that we've just received our drill permits for the Sandy Gold Project for trading, chasing a high-grade epithermal gold project, depth of that project. Interesting project just outside of Reno. We've done some geophysics just recently. We're actually in the middle of interpreting them to add to the intelligence we'll have on that project to put forth the drill program commencing probably the middle of October, maybe 8 to 10 holes, 1,500 meters. Interesting part about that project I mentioned last time, we're right in the middle of another company that has raised $20 million advancing a similar style of mineralization just immediately to the west of us. We staked our project for a couple thousand dollars last year out of our database, did some geophysics, property visit, mapping. We're ready. So that's an interesting project. That is the first of three drill programs that we will be commencing in the next 2 months. So that's Sandy. Interesting project. But staying in Nevada, if you head a little north, just west of Winnemucca, we're chasing what we believe is a similar project to the historical Sleeper Mine that was found and discovered after multiple holes and yielded one of the highest grade intercepts and one of the highest grade projects ever mined in Nevada. I think they mined the first few thousand tons at 16 or 15.7 ounces per ton.
Yes, it was amazing.
Absolutely. And here we are just to the west of that project, similar rocks, geology, surface expression. Last year we stuck a few what we call blind holes into the project, and we hit some interesting mineralization. It was low grade last year, but our technical team, which is comprised of some of the greatest minds in the mining industry, two of them, Dr. Quinton Henney and Dr. Odin Christensen, took a look at the holes from last year and said, you know, low grade, but I think we might be on top of something. We'll come back next year. Our goal is to always manage our dollars, make sure we put the dollars into the ground and not into the into our pockets. So we came back this spring, and COVID delayed it by a couple of months, but we went back and we did what is called a CSAMT survey, which really is a geophysical survey method that allows you to look on the vertical scale of the project subsurface from where you previously drilled or your previous interpretation, and look for an anomaly that will allow us to pinpoint our drill holes probably within 2 to 3 meters of where we need to be. So we completed the survey, and we just announced a couple of weeks ago, since we since I last spoke to you, in the early September, some spectacular geophysical targets that a couple of our technical teams say they've never seen such an interesting and exciting CSAMT survey target. So that one, we actually just last week put forth a drill permit application. We'll be looking to do a follow-up program deeper from the 2019 program and stick about 10 holes, maybe about 1,000 feet, a little bit deeper each, yielding about 2,500 meters. So we have an exciting next couple of months in Nevada.
Interesting, very interesting. Well, I can't help but notice the similarity of the name, the Sleeper and the Slumber. And I'm just wondering so, you know, I was actually on that project. I worked for ING. Actually, I worked for Westpac Banking Corp, and we were part of the financing group that financed for Amex, the mining company, put that into production. I was there. But, Peter, you know, that was that incredibly high-grade area. And they had a lot of low-grade stuff out around as well. I think they might have done some heap leaching as well. But then they found this incredible, without the tools that you have today, I might add, I think they didn't have the same capabilities as you have now to look at what you're doing. So who knows? Maybe you'll come up with something similar. A Sleeper and the Slumber.
We were actually talking internally that it took, I'm not sure how many holes, 38 or 48 holes to actually finally hit what they believe was sitting subsurface at Sleeper. And here we are about 8 holes in. We've got the CSAMT done. And we're heading back. And if you go to the website and look under the press release dated in September under slumber, you'll see a drill hole that just maybe wasn't drilled deep enough. But we'll go back. We'll put the drill program in. I'll put the drill program together and see what comes out of there.
Whoa, very exciting. Okay, so but you have also this project up in British Columbia. Tell us the Exodus project. What have you done there since I know you just had acquired it recently, but what have you done there on the Exodus?
Yeah, so absolutely. So Exodus will be our third drill program that we're looking to do, potentially commencing early November. We're in the middle of permitting. We just acquired the project exactly last time we spoke in early July. Since then, we've actually completed a property-wide geophysical survey just to really look at the lineaments and surface structures identified from the geophysics. We've done and completed but awaiting assays for a 2-square-kilometer soil grid. Looks interesting out of the gate. We're still waiting for a number of assays to come in to really put the model together. We've unearthed at surface what we believe is additional veins, but you know, we need to look at it, get the assays in from the channel samples that are cutting across the multiple veins that have been, I guess, discovered in addition to the original veins that were there. And the one thing about this project, central British Columbia, we're halfway from Vancouver to the Yukon, right next to a paved highway, a few kilometers from a railway, power line, pipeline, community. You can drive to site, stay in an Airbnb. It's going to be a very active project during the month of October into November with assays. We're just putting together a drill program for probably 1,500 meters, maybe 8 holes, just to test it. It'll be the very first program ever drilled in this area of British Columbia. So we're excited to test it, and it's kind of early stages, but we're excited.
Yeah. Well, three drill programs that are going to be, initial drill programs in each case, I guess. So it's going to be very exciting. And how is your budget? How is your finances right now? I guess you have enough money to finance these programs, or are you going to have to raise some more?
No, absolutely. We are 100% fully financed to complete all three drill programs and left with probably just under $2 million still in the treasury after we complete these programs. That's our budget. Just a little bit about that. We completed two financings this year, one at 14 cents in May 26th. All that paper just recently came free trading. We're up about 130% from that financing.
Wow, that's good.
And we're seeing a lot of good shareholders sticking in with the story. They're here for what they believe our technical team can yield on a potential discovery. We did a second financing, closed August 24th, of about $3 million. So anybody looking at the company right now, we're trading at about 32 to 33 cents Canadian. And you can buy in the same price or take a look at the company at the same price the financing was about a month ago.
Yeah. Yeah, that's I guess this pullback in gold and silver has sort of helped people catch their breath a little bit, and a possibility of getting in to a story like yours at a very reasonable level. So I think this is really exciting. And you, speaking of your shareholders, with a minute left here, who are your major shareholders?
Well, I think that the main key thing about the shareholder distribution is the chairman and myself are two of the largest shareholders of the company. Uh-huh. But we also have the likes of Eric Sprott is just sub or around 10% of the shareholdings. Uh-huh. We have a new two groups, some reputable firms out of Denver, Crescat Capital, a leading precious metal group, and another group out of Boston. And then we also have two corporates that have invested into the company. So we have significant distribution between institutional, high net worth, and significant shareholders like Eric Sprott. And management team, we put our own money into the company to ensure that we can be part of the shareholders that join us with the company. $64 million out. We have about $1.7 million also of warrants in the money and a chip of the $3 million in the bank as of last week.
All right. Well, it's just certainly if you come through with some good drill results, I'm sure the share price is going to be substantially higher. You'll do your next financing, hopefully at double or triple the current price. That would be great. At least that'd be great for someone like myself who bought the shares at these or lower prices. So really looking forward. Anything else you'd like to add with 30 seconds left?
No, with that, I really appreciate everyone just taking a look at NV Gold. Just one note, I try to be the most accessible CEO in the industry. So the 1-888-363-9883 goes right to my cell phone. So you're not going to get any middle person. Peter at NVGoldCorp.com. Email me, phone me. We welcome all interested.
Well, thank you very much, Peter, for that. That's very generous of you, and we appreciate your time. Thank you for being with us. All right, folks.
Have an amazing day.
You too. We're going to go to break now, but don't go away because Lynn Alvin will be with me, and she always has some great insights into not only what is happening, but why things are happening in the market, and you're not going to want to miss what Lynn has to say about, are we going to have a V-shaped recovery, or what might the future hold economically for America? Don't go away. We'll be right back with Lynn Alden.
NV Gold Corp, trading under NVX on the TSX and NVGLF on the OTC, is a gold exploration company focused on uncovering the next multi-million ounce gold deposit in North America. With an aggressive exploration season ahead in 2020, a tight share structure, strong management ownership, key strategic investors including Eric Sprott, a globally recognized technical team, technical coverage from industry gold experts, and cash in its treasury. Visit NVGoldCorp.com to learn more on this exciting story.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really honored to have with me Lynn Alden. She's here for a second time. I think probably a lot of you are aware of Lynn. She seems to be gaining a lot of traction, and for good reason, because she provides, I think, a lot of great insights into not only what's happening in the markets, but why things are taking place as they are, and that's the kind of person we'd like to have on this show. We don't want to just know what's going up and down, but what's why? What are the reasons so that we can prepare for the future and try to understand the markets as best we can? So Lynn has a background as an engineer, and it's just an incredible background. She's had she's also been very active in advising in financing and managing money and so forth. So she has had a lot of coverage in the mainstream media, Forbes, MarketWatch, Times Money Magazine, The Daily Telegraph, The Street, CNBC, U.S. News and World Report, Kiplinger. It goes on and on. So we're really pleased and honored to have Lynn with us again. And I should mention again, it's lynnalden.com, Lynn Alden, A-L-D-E-N, L-Y-N, Alden.com. To catch up with Lynn, and she does provide a great deal of very heavy-duty, I would say, substantive free stuff that you can take advantage of. She also, though, does charge a very, I think, very reasonable amount for the for advice that she passes on for investors as well. Lynn, thank you so much for joining us again.
Hey, thanks for having me again. I appreciate it.
I really am glad that you can be with us because I know that it's interesting. We have a son who's in his early 30s, and he started to get interested in investing. But I was a little surprised that we mentioned, my wife and I, when we talked to him last weekend, that, yeah, he knew your name. So that was
oh, nice.
That was pretty interesting. He's out in California, and We don't see him that often because we're here in New York City. But in any event, we talk to him every week about it and more about investing. So, you know, Lynn, most pundits on CNBC and other mainstream financial media, as well as politicians, both parties actually, they seem to focus on COVID-19 as a major reason for our current economic malaise. But you did a great job, I think, in pointing out what I think was a canary in the coal mine back in September 2019 when you explained why the repo market rate surged suddenly up to about 10%, necessitating the need for the Federal Reserve to start pumping money into the system again. Could you perhaps talk a little bit about the mechanics of that? What happened then? And then to what extent is it still an issue or isn't an issue now? And to what extent might have that been telling us something about the systemic issues that we might still be facing now? I don't know. I want to hear what you have to say about that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in any sort of recession, I think there's a lot of media coverage around the catalyst, right?
Yeah.
Because that's the most newsworthy or a headline part, especially because mm-hmm. this was an unusually kind of noteworthy catalyst. So there's a lot of media attention on it. But, you know, the work I've been showing is that there's a lot more meat kind of behind that, which is the amount of debt in the system. And so, you know, a lot of financial indicators saw this coming, even though, of course, they couldn't fully see the pandemic coming. So, for example, the yield curve inverted, you know, like before the pandemic hit. We had slowing GDP ever since the end of 2018. So, you know, we were already kind of in a deceleration phase. And so the pandemic kind of hit us while we were already somewhat weak. And mm-hmm. so the work I did on the repo crisis last year showed that basically we're getting to the point where, you know, we've had so much debt built up in the system, you know, especially on the sovereign side at this point, so federal debt, that, you know, there's not a lot of private buyers for that debt. So, for example, mm-hmm. the foreign sector has not really accumulated too much treasuries in the past 5 or 6 years, and the domestic balance sheets are pretty saturated by that. So what that essentially means is that if the Fed wants to keep interest rates low, they have to gobble up a pretty significant part of ongoing treasury issuance at this time. And that's something we saw. It began, you know, they were trying to do quantitative tightening, but starting with the repo crisis, they had to quickly reverse that and begin, increasing their balance sheet, buying more treasuries. And, of course, that was pre-pandemic. And then they've mm-hmm. had to accelerate that, you know, during this, you know, global slowdown and recession, especially in March and April, they had to buy a ton of treasuries. And then they're still just, you know, they're buying like $80 billion or so a month currently in treasuries.
Mm. Wow. So the problem, if anything, has gotten worse. It means more stimulation. Not stimulation is the wrong word, I think. Just more liquidity needs to be pumped into the system to keep the system from imploding.
Yeah, so you know, one of the ways I characterize this is to show that, you know, most people are aware of the short-term business cycle, which is, you know, you have leverage build up and then there's some sort of catalyst or something happens and you have a deleveraging event, right? So you have kind of malinvestments worked out of the system. Mm-hmm. But because of the way our system works, as soon as we have a deleveraging event, we have a lot of fiscal stimulus and a lot of monetary stimulus. They lower interest rates. And that kind of short circuits the deleveraging event and encourages the system to re-leverage back up. So mm-hmm. over the course of multiple short-term business cycles, they never really deleverage back all the way down. So they deleverage like half the way, and then they start building up from there. So if you string a bunch of those short-term business cycles together into a multi-decade secular trend, you get higher and higher debt as a percentage of GDP, and you get lower interest rates until you hit the zero bound. And so that's what happened, of course, back in 2009. We hit the zero bound. We had extraordinarily high debt, and that's still in play over a decade later now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if anything, more of that debt got up to the sovereign level because we bailed out the private system, you know, a decade ago, and that all, you know, a lot of that got up to the sovereign debt level. And so now we went into this crisis with already having federal debt as over 100% of GDP.
Right. So you have lower and lower rates because the system can't tolerate higher rates. And the deeper into this multi-short-term cycle you go, like the more of these short-term cycles that pile on top of each other, the lower the rates go, the higher the debt is. And so interest rates don't go back up just simply because the manipulation by the Fed. You would think that if there's a shortage of money around, you know, if the Fed didn't keep pumping, that rates would go up. You'd have a very severe recession, perhaps, or maybe not that severe if you left it happen on an ongoing, if you weren't involved with manipulating the monetary system on a regular basis, perhaps you would have these little tiny, cycles, adjustments, I should say, with rates going up. Or do you think that that there's something systemic about it? There's nothing that, in other words, what I'm trying to ask, is it the result of the Federal Reserve or central banks in general that cause or exacerbate the pileup of debt on top of each other because they don't want to allow, or the politicians don't allow them to let the free market adjust naturally?
Yeah, I think it's a blend of fiscal and monetary policy. Looking at interest rates in particular, it's a self-reinforcing loop. So, lower interest rates allow for more debt accumulation, mm-hmm. but as debt goes higher and higher, it makes it impossible to raise rates. So it kind of pushes rates down, and that of course allows more debt accumulation, and that keeps happening until you reach the zero bound. I think, decades ago, monetary policymakers could have gone in a different direction. For example, under Greenspan, they could have had less dovish monetary policy, and that could have prevented some of this debt accumulating as high as it did. Mm-hmm. However, because of the path they chose, the challenging thing now is that they're so backed into a corner, right? So now, no matter who you put in charge of the Fed, it's kind of like just a set of bad choices to choose from, right? Because they're never going to be in a situation where they let, say, the sovereign just nominally default, right? Because all banks around the country hold treasuries as part of their risk-free collateral. So if you had a treasury default, you would have a default of the entire banking system, which would be systemic. So mm-hmm. because of that, they're into that corner. They essentially have to make sure that the treasury market stays liquid, but that comes with its own kind of downside, which can be currency devaluation, negative real interest rates, and all sorts of things like that. So it's really tough because they had choices decades ago, and now they have very few choices.
Very few choices left. But in the article that you wrote about a century of fiscal and monetary policy, you really outlined the difference between these short term debt cycles, and then the one that accumulates, the cumulative one, the one that happens every 80 or 100 years or so, I guess. And so it really has. As you say, there's not many choices left. So how does this thing play out?
Yeah,
and how do you think it will play out? Because as you point out in your article, monetary policy becomes less and less effective, it seems, as these cycles pile on top of each other.
Yeah, so in a normal business cycle, you can deleverage nominally if you let it happen. And the problem is when it gets exacerbated into a long-term debt cycle. So you build more and more debt up, and then interest rates get lower and lower. And when they hit the zero bound, that's when you have a long-term debt cycle play out. So, ever since, 2008, 2009, we've been in this, zero or near zero environment. And like you said, the last time that happened was about 80 years ago, starting in the early 1930s. That was the last time we were persistently at the zero bound. And so what happens in that environment is that monetary policy kind of runs out of ammo, so that, their interest rates hit the zero bound, so then they turn into creating bank reserves to buy assets. Notice quantitative easing today, but that doesn't get money into the hands of the people. That doesn't encourage banks to necessarily lend more because they're already kind of levered up. So historically, when you get to the long-term debt cycle, that's when fiscal policy usually takes over and gets more aggressive. So fiscal policy, politicians start usually running much higher fiscal deficits. And so usually what happens is instead of deleveraging nominally, you end up deleveraging in real terms by devaluing currency. So when you have kind of a massive amount of debt relative to GDP or relative to money supply, and because it's a fiat system, they can essentially expand the monetary supply significantly. So what we've seen this year, and what we've seen 80 years ago last time this happened, is you have a very rapid increase in the broad money supply, and so you end up deleveraging debt relative to broad money without ever actually decreasing debt. But of course, the downside to that is anyone holding cash in a bank or holding sovereign bonds or other kind of low yielding, supposedly safe assets can lose a lot of their purchasing power, and that's it's a very challenging time for investors in this environment because stocks are highly valued, but then they ask where they're going to go, And if you look at the bond market, you know, bonds are giving you negative real yields. So their yields are lower than the underlying inflation rate. And so there's not a lot of safe havens, especially in kind of, you know, some of the most mainstream assets for investors to flock to.
Yeah. No place to go, no place to run, no place to hide. It seems where you can really go. And, you know, normally you would go into treasuries in these other earlier cycles and get a reasonable return, at least maybe, you know, and then you can come back out and buy stocks after they've bottomed out at some point and make a lot of money that way. But it seems as though the system itself is now in some deep trouble. And so we had Roosevelt back in the 30s and all the public works programs and all those ways. And now we're seeing massive numbers of people who are having difficulty paying their rents. We're having the CDC, for whatever reason, I don't know what gives them the authority to tell people they don't have to pay their rents to landlords. And landlords certainly have to pay their mortgages to the banks, I would think. And you would think that somewhere along the way, there's going to be some big trouble unless there is a lot of money that's created out of nothing and pumped into the system, right?
Yeah, that's kind of the two choices they have. They can either let kind of a big nominal collapse happen, right, because there's so much debt in the system. And, you know, the middle class at this point is pretty insolvent because we have a very high degree of wealth concentration. So, you know, I think a lot of people look too much at, you know, debt relative to income, but they don't separate out the different kind of income quintiles, right? So a lot of the assets are held by, you know, the top 10% or so, whereas a lot of the debts are actually in kind of the lower groups. And so, you know, for the average person, their expenses have gone up a lot more quickly than their income, which has made it very difficult to save, and they've ended up taking out a lot of debt in many cases. So, you know, they're kind of in a situation now where, you know, they're stuck between if they don't do stimulus, you know, they're likely to have more bank failures, they're likely to have more civil unrest, likely to have, you know, kind of weaker corporate profits. And then, of course, you know, because our system is kind of very influenced by money, a lot of those corporate, CEOs and investors are donors, political donors. They, you know, so politicians are under pressure by them. So both from the public in terms of civil unrest and from the investor class, from donors, there's not a lot of kind of inbuilt incentive to not do stimulus, other than kind of political gamesmanship. If when they do stimulus, of course, then the offset of that is usually get more currency weakness. It's kind of like just choosing between different ways to kind of deflate a bubble. Whenever they kind of have control over the printing press, they usually try to go the printing route.
Mm-hmm. The easiest way out, it seems.
Yeah.
Well, then you talk about, you know, we're seeing these riots in the major cities, a lot of destruction, some loss of life at this stage by a couple of groups, Antifa and Black Lives Matter. What I hear you saying is there's probably some, not necessarily what is being sold as the reason for all this, but there's probably a lot of other deep-seated issues of anxiety throughout, especially younger people who are having difficulty coming out of college, paying their debts, and finding jobs, and so forth. But I'm wondering if you've I'm guessing you've read The Fourth Turning.
Yes, yeah, I've actually mentioned that in a couple different podcasts too. And if you look back in history, so the long-term debt cycles, they're all fourth turnings. You know, that kind of big kind of debt buildup and deleveraging event generally comes with a pretty big societal shift at those points because it's a very polarizing period every time it happens.
Yeah. So it's like every four generations or so. So it's an 80 to 100 year period. So the last one was the 1930s. I guess before that, we would have been looking in the U.S. history. We would have been looking at the Civil War, maybe. And
yeah.
So these are big. This is a big event that we have, I think, playing out here. I listened to Ray Dalio recently talking about, the question was posed to him on Bloomberg whether the dollar could be in trouble, and he says, yes, I think it could be in trouble. There's no other currency to go to right now, but people are going to gold. They're going to things that will save value because certainly you can't go to treasuries to save value. You're the real rate of return is negative there, and maybe inflation starts to rise a little bit too because you've had some supply chain issues related to COVID, perhaps maybe some more coming. People unemployed, they're not producing anything, but they're getting paychecks. what this looks like. Could be a lot of issues ahead. What about the dollar's future? How do you see that? And inflation? Do you see potential for rising inflation then, given this fiscal stimulus that's going to be accommodated with monetary printing, obviously?
Yeah, so my base case is to see kind of a more multipolar currency reserve world, which means that the dollar could shift from being the global reserve currency to a global reserve currency, mm-hmm. meaning like one of several. Mm-hmm. And one example to look at is that 2 years ago, the trade between Russia and China was about 85% dollars. Mm-hmm. And over the past 2 years, they've significantly de-dollarized down to about 45% dollars. Uh-huh. And euros have taken the lion's share of that difference. And so that's not to say that the euro is going to replace the dollar, because the euro has its own problems. But what it means is that, you know, instead of all global energy, for example, being priced in dollars, it can be potentially priced in a couple different major currencies. So Russia has been pushing to try to price energy in euros. And, you know, China's, you know, been interested in kind of, you know, being able to price commodities outside of the dollar system. So I think, you know, starting from some of those countries that are like less friendly to the United States and that are less pleased with kind of the monopoly that the dollar has on global mm-hmm. commodity pricing, you can kind of see it start from there and spread out. And I mean, to some extent, that's a return to how it's been in the past, because even though there's, you know, for centuries, there's always been a global reserve currency, it's actually been, this is an unusual period where one currency is used to price like all commodities worldwide. So yes. that's a very unusual period. And so, you know, I think we're kind of shifting away from that period, because the U.S. is no longer, it's no longer the biggest commodity importer, that's China. And two, just, you know, it's as the world's gotten kind of bigger and more interconnected, you know, they have more opportunities to try to, you know, kind of have a more multipolar system. And if you look back over the past 5 years, central banks have not really been buying treasuries too rapidly. In recent years, they've actually been increasing their exposure to gold a little bit. So in that sense, you know, kind of those currencies become medium of exchanges, but they're not necessarily the store of value. So central banks kind of might price things in dollars, but then instead of continuing to build treasury on their balance sheet at least at the rate they have been, you know, they can look at other sort of neutral settlement assets like gold.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, you know, China is supposedly the world's largest gold producer, and they don't export gold. Russia's a large producer. Both of those countries have been building up gold too, I would imagine. They're doing what a lot of private citizens are doing, the Ray Dalios of this world and yourself and a lot of us that have been buying gold or gold-related assets, realizing that, you know, not that gold is going up in value, but that the currencies are losing their purchasing power. So I guess it's hard to predict how this will play out, but as you say, that you can just watch and see that the dollar is losing its influence, its prominence, I guess, as a currency. Primary currency, I guess. So, Lynn, I guess what can we take from this in terms of our own investing? I was suggesting just now, I guess I made a suggestion that gold and silver and tangibles. But what about the stock market? I mean, you're not just a gold bug like I am. I'm more of a gold bug, sort of a philosophical Austrian school belief system. But you are very practical. You're a scientist and you're an engineer. What are you doing with your investing in general terms now? And I know that you do provide specific information to your subscribers, to your paid subscribers, as well as provide a lot of free stuff on the internet. But if you could, with the last 3 or 4 minutes that we have here, just tell us sort of what you're doing in your investment world.
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, the best investments kind of shift over time based on valuations and different areas of growth. So, for example, you know, I turned bullish on gold and silver and their miners back in 2018. So we've had that as a pretty significant chunk of the portfolio since then, and that's been one of the best performing areas. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, of course, we've also had very good performance from some of these growth stocks. So, for example, mm-hmm. we've had, you know, companies like Adobe or NVIDIA in their portfolio that have recently actually had to trim because they've gotten so expensive and so highly valued. So it's kind of a it's kind of a curse, right? If an investment does well enough, sometimes you have to trim it from the portfolio. So, sure. I don't go all into gold and gold stocks and silver. I incorporate that as a part of the portfolio. So what I do is I look at a blend of individual stocks and sometimes ETFs as well. So, you know, I rotate out of stocks that I think have become overvalued. I get into other stocks that I think are, offer kind of better risk-adjusted returns, taking into account their growth rate, their valuation, any dividends they might pay, their balance sheet strength, things like that. So I'm still finding opportunities in U.S. markets, but they're kind of they're not very abundant just because markets in general are pretty highly valued, especially compared to the economic damage that's currently happening. Mm-hmm. And looking abroad, I think that there are some opportunities internationally as well. Those markets tend to be a little bit cheaper, and they've of course had like a decade long period of underperformance relative to U.S. Stocks. So many of them are at somewhat more reasonable valuations, and there are kind of trouble spots to avoid. But overall, I think that there are pretty good international equity opportunities. And then also, I've been increasingly looking at some of the base commodity space. So we've been interested in the copper producers, some of the beaten down oil producers that are actually kind of really strongly positioned. Ones with less debt, that have tons of reserves, that have low cost of production. Because they can outlast some of the weaker shale companies and things like that. So by basically having a pretty diverse portfolio and then kind of shifting towards areas of value. And then it is somewhat controversial, but, in April we added a small Bitcoin position as well to some of the portfolios at around, I think it was just under 7,000 of Bitcoin. And so that's been a pretty good bullish move from there as well. So
very good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And tell, with 30 seconds left here, tell our listeners your service, because you outline all of those ideas, of course, in your paid service, right?
Yeah, so that's available at lindalden.com. I have tons of free material, but I also have that paid premium service for any investors that want to get some more specific information.
Ideas. Yeah, they're very good. Lynn, thank you so much for being with us. Very interesting ideas that you pass along and understanding of the markets. It's greatly appreciated your time. All the best to you, and thanks again for being with us once again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been fun.
You bet. All right, folks. Well, that is it for this week. Next week, James Perloff will be with me. He's written a book titled COVID-19 and the Agenda to Come. Also, Ian Clausen, the president of Grand Portage, will be with me. He's got a very exciting company, very high-grade gold deposit in Alaska. You'll be here to talk to us about that. So until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.